Hello and welcome to That's a Thing, a sometimes belated, already outdated guide to your teens, tweens, and everything under 20. I'm Elizabeth.
And I'm Karen, and we're a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported.
This is our 50th episode, and we're just going to gloss right over that because I don't prepare celebrations. but what I want to do is complain about my negligent childhood, deprived of so many things.
Oh, no.
And what I mean by that is I grew up in a terrible time for camp. Not the pastime, camping, which I spent a significant amount of my childhood doing and absolutely refused to do ever again, but the sensibility. Capital C camp, childlike aesthetic, misguided passion. In her 1964 essay, Notes on Camp, Susan Sontag emphasizes that camp is a sensibility, an approach to things which is amoral, wholly aesthetic. It's like kind of kitsch with a soul. The pure examples of camp are unintentional, she says. They are dead serious. It seems unlikely that much of, say, traditional opera repertoire could be such satisfying camp if the melodramatic absurdities of most opera plots had not been taken seriously by their composers. Sontag argues, in pure camp, the essential element is seriousness. A seriousness that fails. Of course, not all seriousness that fails can be redeemed as camp, only that which has the proper mixture of the exaggerated, the fantastic, the passionate, and the naive. She concludes that camp taste is above all a mode of enjoyment, of appreciation, not judgment. Camp is generous. It wants to enjoy. Camp taste finds success in certain passionate failures.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I deprived you of that?
No, my upbringing did kind of detached from that. So This is going to be a bit of a messy episode because I'm trying to untangle messy feelings about art and morality that were largely instilled in me actually by the internet culture of the late 2000s and early 2010s. So many of the creative anxieties I run into can be traced back to media criticism on YouTube and Twitter. And if I'd been on Tumblr, I'm sure that would have also been a source of this artistic anxiety. So we're going to talk about a bunch of loosely related stuff that ties back to that. And basically, this is just me like shaking out all of the loose change in my brain so that I can feel happy about creation again. But first, we're going to do an ad.
Okay. I'm very excited about this.
You will lose your joy.
All right. This episode is brought to you by Boys and Girls Clubs and Big Brothers Big Sisters of Edmonton. So, Elizabeth, did you know that you have a superpower?
You weren't supposed to know about those.
Well, we're not talking about flying or reading minds, so those would be pretty cool to have if those are the ones that you're obliquely referring to. You have the incredible ability to help young people see their own superpowers. Boys and Girls Clubs and Big Brothers Big Sisters of Edmonton and area, who are also called the BGC Bigs, need you now. Consider sharing your time with a young person. Over the past year, BGC Bigs heard from young people that having a mentor means they are less likely to have anxiety, feel isolated, or struggle with their mental health. But there are more than 600 young people waiting for a mentor in their lives today. Explore how you can get involved and watch our community change one life at a time. There's currently a need for mentors in the Big Brothers, Big Sisters, or Big Siblings program in school, for the Youth in Care program, and for the new PRISM program, which is supporting 2S LGBTQ plus young people. There's also a need for virtual tutors who can support young people as they transition back to school and are dealing with learning loss over the past 2 years. So, listeners, if you are interested in learning more about this, join BGC Bigs for a virtual coffee or apply now at bgcbigs.ca. Might be easier just to Google BGC Bigs Edmonton. It's your priority and their future.
Absolutely. We're going to be talking a lot about kids and how to support kids in becoming thinking responsible adults in this episode.
That's a nice tie-in.
Apt sponsor, yes.
Yeah.
So the late 2000s, early 2010s internet culture was so bad at approaching things with the grace of camp.
Okay.
Like, I think sometimes people see you call something camp and you're just kind of trying to politely call it bad.
Right.
That's not what it is. Like, mm-hmm. some people might do that, but it's far more a case of letting go of good and bad as measurements of enjoyment and being able to say, I enjoyed this thing, and I can say this was handled poorly or that was handled poorly or the whole thing was handled poorly, but I enjoyed this thing, and that is the part that is important to me. Late 2000s, early 2010s internet culture didn't like enjoying things. It's a thing that YouTubers bemoan a lot, actually, that the negative take always gets more clicks.
Oh.
I don't know what part of our horrible lizard brains that we threw into this modern techropolis is being triggered by that. Yeah. But there's like this human instinct to always go for the negative, and it created this immense toxicity on the internet where people were not bound in by having a like structured society there. So this was the angry reviewer area, and everybody, all of the kids, like me included, John included, everybody, watched these guys. So you had CinemaSins, Nostalgia Critic, like 1,000 copycats, all doing their best to steal your enjoyment of flawed art and instill a binaristic good or bad approach to taste.
Right.
So the one guy who kind of started this trend and at the same time was like the one good guy was the angry video game nerd.
Okay.
And that is because he was so over the top that it was always very clear he was a character and he was like talking about stuff from a place of love. When you look at CinemaSins, are you familiar with CinemaSins?
I feel like I've heard the name, but I don't know that I've ever watched.
If you've ever heard like a ding sound effect used in a YouTube video, that's a reference to CinemaSins.
Okay.
So what they would do is they would pick movies and they would just go through them, nitpicking them for all of the like usual surface level film bro things.
Mm.
So there would be something like this line of dialogue didn't make sense, or this moment didn't make sense, or whatever. And so they would say that. They would say like 20 seconds of credits, that's too much. And then there would be like a ding sound effect and it would indicate a CinemaSin hazard.
Okay.
And it's just, it's not good. And they're the kind of guys who constantly hide behind it being parody when it's clearly not parody.
Right.
So there have been several really good takedown videos of this that talk about how damaging this good or bad checkmark list kind of approach to film criticism is. But it doesn't matter because those didn't come out till years after. And so I got like a face full of like, here's how you make bad movie and here's what make movie bad. And you're only getting the worst moments of the movie. So you can't decide if you would have enjoyed the movie.
Right.
In spite of them or because of them.
And what you really enjoy is somebody really hating something.
Yeah,
which is
exactly.
Kind of
exactly.
Cynical,
like,
and gross.
It's the kind of thing you watch when you already don't like the movie.
Right.
Right. And then Nostalgia Critic, which started off kind of as a character talking about notoriously bad movies and became a man who wanted a career he couldn't have, slowly disintegrating into the thing he was originally pretending to be. Hi, Doug.
We must link not only to his stuff, but to Dan Olson's takedown of his thing.
But these guys, they prided accuracy, realism, logical consistency, and they destroyed any useful meaning for the term plot hole faster than Twitter can dismantle the latest viral mental health term. You're gaslighting me. You're love bombing me. You're a narcissist. There was one meme I saw that was a stock image of a mother like picking up a box of toys to put on a shelf and like a pouty child down below, and it was just like the latest mental health buzzword that was losing all of its meaning.
Right.
Among all of the other ones. It's great. Anyway, they did that to the term plot hole, and now anytime I see that as a criticism, it's like putting like junk food in my body. I can feel my organs rejecting it. My introduction to media criticism was shallow and cheap and more interested in easy digs than understanding why something doesn't work or admitting that it could be up to personal taste, right? People got really afraid of it's my opinion.
This is so interesting because I was under this kind of utopian feeling that you have like access to more interesting opinions about more culture than I ever did in my whole life. And it isn't mediated through the usual gatekeepers where, like, if I wanted to hear someone talk about movies, I had to like stay up once a week and watch Siskel and Ebert. Like, that was it. That is what I got. That was what I had access to. So I was thinking, how amazing. There's like all of these people who are presumably putting smart things on the internet, but I guess not. And you, all you need to do is just find it.
Well, the thing is, I was very specific about my era here. Mm. And this is when I was like in middle school and watching YouTube. And what most of what I've shown you is the video essay era, mm-hmm. which is more current
yes.
to what we have now. And that's where we get a lot of really insightful videos. And actually, a lot of the people who pioneered that did come out of that angry reviewer space
okay.
and managed to carve out niches for themselves with more nuance and more grace and more insight.
Right.
So I do like a lot of the theory that I'm familiar with now I got from YouTube. A lot of my understanding of media criticism now does come from YouTube. But the time I was growing up was a really bad time for that, which is why I say I grew up in a really bad time for camp.
Okay.
It was hard to recognize things as camp and embrace things as camp and have media that you liked without it being quote unquote good,
mm.
right? There wasn't a lot of room for that. People who watched these videos and then didn't enjoy English class can be seen absolutely miserable in the comment sections of the latest Disney Marvel Star Wars release to this day. Like, you can spot them. You can be like, that's one of them. especially the takes on the latest Disney movie have been really bad for that. And like, grown men nitpicking a movie for children for not being logically consistent. And it's like, what are you doing? You have so much you could, like, just watch your favorite nostalgia movie again. You don't need to do this.
Yeah.
Perhaps even worse, though, was this era was the golden era of the lolcow. Are you familiar with what a lolcow is? Okay, so a lolcow is a person that kind of naively creates things that people find funny. So you can milk them for lols by interacting with them.
Okay.
Read bullying.
Right.
You can cyberbully them and then you can laugh at them being upset by that.
Ugh.
Yeah. So it gets kind of erased now, but a lot of early memes virality came from targeted cyberbullying campaigns against individuals who were deemed cringe.
Right.
Just as creators like PewDiePie were able to cultivate deeply attached and supportive fandoms who furthered their notoriety, these people incidentally, just by like existing on the internet, sometimes even against their will, they incidentally collected equally passionate anti-fandoms, gathering in unmoderated spaces like Chan boards and later Kiwi Farms. Are you familiar with Kiwi Farms?
No.
Oh God, you will hate Kiwi Farms.
No.
Okay, so it started off as a board to harass one specific person.
Okay.
And later it expanded into harassing a lot of people, especially any person who is trans and online. They're really passionate about that. They're a center for doxing, a center for swatting. So that's when you release personal details about somebody and when you call a SWAT team to their house. Also kind of wild that people are allowed to just call SWAT teams to people's houses. Like, I don't think that's a good policing thing, on a side note. But also, like, people should know not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's absolutely horrifying spaces where these anti-fandoms gathered to harass and cyberbully, and probably, if the law was caught up to the internet, do criminal actions against people who were often not able to defend themselves. Like, it's hard ever to defend yourself from like 100 strangers,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But these people were especially not equipped to do that. I'm not going to name or link any examples of little cows.
Yeah.
And that's because further exposure of them and their stories is only ever going to harm them. I do not want to connect people's names with a demeaning term like that.
Yeah.
I consider these groups, these harassment groups, cultic anti-fandoms. So basically, they organize themselves on boards like fandoms. So like a group of people who have a shared interest that they want to communicate with each other about and organize around. But they also behave like cults. They have in-group language. They have intense control over their members, intense loyalty to the in-group, like all of these things. It's like the middle ground between a fandom and a cult is what you see when the cult forms around something like harassing a person or an ideology. Like what you want to see in art, instead of just I like My Little Pony or whatever.
Right.
So they dox, they swat, they harass, they bully, they defame, they have ruined and ended lives. And this was extremely normalized in that time period, that like sweet spot time period where I was first autonomous on the internet.
Right.
And what that kind of subconsciously taught me and a lot of people is be very careful about what you put out there, because it could actually permanently ruin your life.
Yeah.
Without the toxic dopamine pits of internet community, the targets of this harassment would never have reached this level of notoriety and would have been able to live out their lives undisturbed. And we would all be way better off for it. A handful of viral videos and like blind films have since been embraced as camp. The one that I will note is Leave Britney Alone, which has kind of been reclaimed by the Free Britney movement as like based actually.
Yeah.
And that's a moment of like camp turning into like power and people recognizing it for that. A more measured and sympathetic approach to acknowledging this ostentatiously flawed material, basically, could have happened if the internet was equipped to have that nuanced look at things and not be mean to individuals and just have that separation between the thing that was put out and the person who made it, right? But there's never been that separation on the internet. The internet always brings author and audience closer together.
Right.
And when you're kind of an unwilling author or not seeking an audience, then that can be really traumatic. And watching that as somebody who potentially wants to write things, put things out there, create things like me, that was traumatic, like watching that happen to people. And while the most obvious examples of such fandom behavior tend to be connected with right-leaning ideologies like Gamergate and Turfism, it does not have a political affiliation.
Mm.
And the things that have been most like traumatic for me and stuck with me is this happening within like left-wing Twitter circles.
Right.
Tumblr, now Twitter, fandom culture has been dominated by two massive cultic fandoms, ideological fandoms, over the past year. And those are pro-shippers and antis. Have you heard either of those terms before?
I think that we have kind of workshopped some of these ideas along the way. And so, and we talked about shipping like a long time ago, where it was just, I don't know, perhaps
like just me talking about the language and like a much younger shipping culture, because it kind of changes as you get older, the spaces you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So like back then I was in very junior shipping culture. And I've never really participated in shipping culture, just as a side note, because I don't like get that attached to that aspect of art.
But just before you go on, what we're talking about, in case you didn't listen to that episode that we did like 3 years ago, it's imagining a relationship between shipping is imagining a relationship between characters in a fictional
Or real people.
Yeah. Right?
It's like boy band members or whatever.
Yeah.
It's imagining a relationship between two people.
Right.
And a shipping fandom is the group of people who rally up around that and make material for each other about that and stuff.
And then anti-shipping is what?
Okay, so obviously the terms pro and anti are prefixes. They originated to identify one's approach to specific ships. So if you liked the ships between, say, Rey and Kylo in the latest Star Wars trilogy, you would identify as a Reylo.
Okay.
Which is like the ship name. You are the ship name, mm-hmm. basically. If you hated that ship, you would be an anti-Reylo or a Reylo anti, basically. Okay. So that's where that came from. It would basically be a way to identify, like, I'm not going to post about that. Don't post to me about that. It's not my jam, right? Mm-hmm. These prefixes have since morphed into identifying terms for two groups taking opposite stances on the morality of not only shipping culture, but art in general. I imagine this will be very nuanced and reasonable. So what would you guess that a pro-shipper supports?
In general?
Yeah.
Well, like, I think they support the sort of secondary creation of art based on other art. No?
No. Okay. A pro-shipper supports problematic ships.
Oh.
We're using the very useful term problematic here. Oh. This is, of course, expressed in a wide spectrum of ways, and it could mean things that would be criminal in real life. It could mean, like, a taboo power dynamic,
right?
And what it actually means is anything that an anti doesn't like at any given moment. This culture war, of course, does not lend itself to nuance. So what would you say that an anti's take would be? So if a pro shipper thinks that problematic, whatever mm-hmm. that means, ships should exist, what would an anti?
An anti thinks that problematic ships shouldn't exist, but maybe sees problems where they aren't actually.
Well, problematic fiction, according to antis, should not exist or should be quarantined from those who do not consent to seeing. Okay. So there's basically a spectrum of opinion here. Not only on what qualifies as problematic, but also what to do about that once you decide that problematic fan fiction bad.
Right.
So there are people who are like, no fiction in general that is problematic should exist. I don't want to ever have to see it. Nobody should ever have to see it. You shouldn't make it. Some people are like, there needs to be very specific spaces that are for this, so it never comes across my feed and doesn't come across other people's feeds that I'm speaking for whether I should be or not. So, not very compatible if you're taking harsh, binaristic, extreme stances. Otherwise, most people will land in a middle ground and say mm-hmm. they both have reasonable points, mm-hmm. which is very fun for people who aren't involved in the culture war but do post online. there's a lot of conflict around moderation and who gets what spaces. So in general, pro shippers feel that children are invading adult fandom spaces and they're being made to sanitize themselves because all of these little kids are coming in and saying they're uncomfortable after they walked into the room, right? So this is kind of the dead dove do not eat approach. So dead dove do not eat is a long-term fan fiction term, and it comes from some sort of TV show or something. But a guy goes into a fridge and he pulls out a bag and it says, dead dove, do not eat. And he goes, oh, and then he opens it and he's like, I don't know what I expected. And there was a dead dove in there. And so you label your fan fiction as that when you acknowledge that it has themes in it that a lot of people are not going to want to interact with. And so you basically go, like, here is your warning. This will be upsetting to most people. If you do not want to be upset, do not interact with this. I would not want you to be upset by this.
Yeah.
So, like, don't, basically. Generic antis feel that non-consenting individuals are having their space invaded by hazardous content. So they feel like the tagging systems aren't adequate or people aren't using them or it just shouldn't be on this or that website and they're being exposed to stuff that makes them uncomfortable or they consider dangerous or whatever their argument is at any given time.
Right.
So they both have their own language and coding and subcultures, different terms for each other, all of this cultic fandom stuff that makes it very difficult to go into those spaces and understand what they're talking about, mm-hmm. and very different to have communication between them because they have all of these disparaging names and takes on what the other believes, right? So it's all very bad for communication and resolving disputes. Antis stereotypically skew young and pro-shippers skew older. So part of this comes from an issue with that period of the internet. Once these fandom spaces were developed and easily accessible, we had the first generation of kids who were quote unquote raised by the internet. Mm-hmm. So this is like me, older, younger millennials, older Gen Z, basically. We had parents who couldn't dream of having our level of internet literacy. I'm sorry, but it's true. And who were unaware of the ubiquity of mature content on the internet.
Yes. Guilty.
So those 90s and early 2000s kids are now adults, and they view their free-range internet as the best version. Because that's the one we had, right? So if nothing horrible happened to you, and people had horrible things happen to them, but if you weren't one of those people, then you go, I got a lot of freedom from that. If we sanitize the internet and make it safer for kids, then you're taking away a thing I fundamentally like about this, and I got through it fine. So why are you coddling these babies?
Right.
Right. And why are you letting the babies dictate my internet?
Yes.
Right. Get off my lawn. As society has become more internet aware, the new smartphone generation is much more critical about their de facto exposure to adult content. The older generation treats gore, Rule 34, harassment of real people, etc., as part of the online experience. And the approach is very individualistic to safety and moderation. You're supposed to remove yourself from situations. You're supposed to decide, I shouldn't be on this website, and stop going to the website. You're not supposed to say, you should change this website to be safer to me. That feels very entitled to people of that age bracket. Generally.
And is age the only differentiating factor?
It's a pretty big differentiating factor. If you look at the other demographics between these two groups, they're virtually identical. Yeah, like you'd think these people would get along, but they have picked this one issue to dig their heels into. And now they don't do anything but fight over it. So basically, the younger generation wants to remove the risk of encountering horrors without relegating themselves to sites made for actual babies.
Right.
So the extremists on both sides are totally hostile to compromise, basically. A fandom mom, can you guess what that term means?
A fandom mom?
Yeah.
Is that like a person in the fandom that tells people what to do? Or tries to protect people from
more the second one. Yeah.
Okay.
So a fandom mom is a self-appointed adult micro-celebrity who seeks notoriety in child-heavy fandom spaces and basically puts themselves as a person who's a safe adult in the area who will then protect all of you from the scary, bad content. So this term is used by pro-shippers to dig at older aunties, but it will also be like claimed by people, and they'll identify as that. And there's been a history of people abusing that power, Okay. Obviously. Like, if you say, I've created a safe space and everything here is safe and I am safe and I am an adult you can come to and should trust, even though you've never met me and have no identifying details about me.
Come visit my candy house, Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah, it's a little bit that. So there's a complicated issue in... anti-spaces of people appointing themselves vigilantes and then kind of taking it upon themselves to quote-unquote educate people in the group about problematic content. And this has led to people posting that content in these spaces, ironically enough and horrifyingly enough, like posting gore so that you know what gore looks like, right? Which is no... it's not logically sound. So that's an internal issue there that people run into, and so there's been a lot of people trying to warn kids about an adult who tries to appoint themselves as a trusted adult in a space. There's an assumption that these people on both sides have that anybody they're responding to shares perfect knowledge of all the fandom drama they've been steeping in. And this is a problem if you want to have an opinion about art or shipping or whatever outside of these groups on somewhere like Twitter. because people will come into your DMs and come into your replies and accuse you of being a pro-shipper and an anti at the same time because you have a moderate take.
Right.
And the harassment has been quite extreme about this before. It has calmed down a little bit since the height of it. But like absolutely wild accusations, oblique references to fandom drama that you would have no reason for knowing anything about, all of this stuff. There's a lot of straw manning, and there's a lot of ship of Theseus and disinterpretation. So the ship of Theseus argument, I've told you about this before, but for the people at home, it's, it's how Twitter takes a statement and like mutates it into something that they can actually feel justified in attacking by taking out different pieces of the argument as they go. So
until by the time people are reacting to it, the original is no longer there.
Yeah. So another term for this is disinterpretation, and we'll link a Twitter thread on that, but it's basically people who are steeped in Twitter conflict, internet conflict, I'm sure this happens on forums, on Reddit as well, they get soaked up in that, and then they immediately want to sort the thing they're reading into good box and bad box, and so they have to read it with the idea of sorting it into that, and so they disinterpret it. They look for clues in it almost algorithmically to determine whether it goes in the good box or the bad box.
Right.
But it's not about you and your drama, and so it goes in neither box because it's not directly connected to that. But, you know, these people are very wrapped up in this. People get so immersed in this culture war nonsense, they can't imagine bystanders not having strong opinions. So they try to sort them into pro-shippers and antis, and then they treat them like somebody who holds the farthest extreme of that view. So a true pro-ship must support all ships regardless of content or nuance. Even if it was somebody like shipping two of their neighbors together, writing a huge fanfic about it, they would have to go, no, I think that's totally cool and should exist and should be everywhere, even if it's harassment, like stuff like that.
Right.
And a true anti must oppose all problematic ships and portrayal of problematic content in media in general. So if you find something problematic in the children's cartoon that you watch, oops, sorry, you can't watch that anymore. You'll become a bad person. And also, you can't interact with anybody who watches it because they're bad people. And you don't want to interact with bad people because that makes you a bad person,
right.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, neither position is realistic or tenable, and nobody actually holds them if you think critically about it.
And maybe an analogous thing in like grown-up world or my age world is we talk about free speech fundamentalists versus, I guess, the other side of that would be some people would ascribe like cancel culture as the other side of that, right? And nobody, like you say, nobody is really
like, I guess what it is this is fake, but Orwellianism, right? That's the term that everybody throws around. It's Orwellian. It's 1984. So pure freedom of speech or Orwellianism, I guess. Yeah. Very cool. I love how the politics are like this. That's great. You might see people have DNI notices. That stands for do not interact.
Okay.
And so it's basically telling people to like just do not follow me, do not reply to me, do not like me, do not retweet me, nothing if you believe this. So I've had people I follow on Twitter, like I follow a lot of artists on Twitter. That's the main thing I use Twitter for, not politics, but it's also inevitable, right? Yeah. All art is political, but also sometimes it's dumb political. But I follow people who have pro-shippers DNI and antis DNI. And I think it's very dumb that they care enough to announce that unless it's on there because they've been being harassed, in which case I get it. But what this is it's consumption becoming activism, which is exactly what pinkwashing wants you to do.
Yes.
you need to justify what you like. So you start attaching morality to what you like. and you need to manufacture a moral reason that you dislike something. So you have to find a way for something that doesn't work for you to be bad.
Mm.
Not just, it doesn't work for me, but it's evil.
Right.
And it's such a horrible approach to art. And what we see is this pathological avoidance of being made uncomfortable. Mm. And it's not always dangerous to be made uncomfortable. Sometimes it's very healthy to be made uncomfortable. There's this lack of perspective these people have. And part of why the touch grass meme got a lot of steam last year is because of this form of argument that was sweeping the space. So touch grass is basically a shutdown reply. So on the playground, like I know you are, but what am I, right? Okay. Or yeah. Like no you.
Yeah.
You reply when you're done, basically. Touch grass is basically a short way of saying you've been online for too long. You don't recognize how tiny this is in the scope of the real world. Go outside and like touch grass. Okay. Like physically put yourself out of this space,
yeah,
and get some perspective, and then you can come back to me, or preferably never come back. So that got really, really common like last summer. Mm. And that's why. Because okay. This kind of useless argument became so common. And if you look at the anti's side, you see a lot of purity culture elements showing up there kind of organically by young people. Mm. Which is really disheartening. It's kind of like neo-Puritanism. It's this regressive and conscious, this regressive and censorious approach to difficult art that's dressed up in social justice language. Couching itself behind safety and comfort, and think of the children as if children cannot handle morally difficult art or approach it with nuance, which they can. This is especially disheartening given the most recent news of a major piece of art being removed from spaces with children, which is the banning of the graphic novel Mouse. Mm-hmm. By a Tennessee school board. By Art Spiegelman, the graphic novel is a visceral retelling of the Holocaust, which focuses on its victims, those who died and those who lived carrying its trauma. It's notable among other books used to teach about the Holocaust, such as The Boy in Striped Pajamas, for refusing to have heroes or big victories. It is bleak because its subject matter is bleak. It is a story of the Holocaust told by a Jewish person from a Jewish perspective. On January 10th, McMinn County School Board voted to ban the Pulitzer-winning book from being taught in its schools over, according to them, a single scene of nudity, violence, and some profanity. They called it too adult-oriented.
Yeah.
For use in their schools. Eighth graders can handle it.
Mm.
In fact, eighth grade is the exact age group we start opening more mature media up to. Mm-hmm. Like, that's exactly the age range where we hit PG-13. And all of a sudden, a ton of movies are, like, opened up for you to just go see.
Yeah.
Right? Because we've decided, like, that's the age where you can determine what you can handle. I don't know if any demographic swears more than eighth graders. that seems like the point where you, like, let go of whatever, like, an anvil will fall from the sky if you say the bad word thing your parents told you. And you want to seem edgy and cool.
Yeah.
Like, I think eighth graders hear a lot of profanity.
Yeah.
It is important for them to hear the truth about this kind of thing from the mouths of survivors, victims, and their children, because otherwise they're going to hear about it secondhand online from TikTok conspiracy theorists. Yes. And that is so much worse.
Plus, it is great art. Like, it's,
yes,
like, aside from the themes and the message and the historical importance, it's just so well done, and
yes,
and kids should be exposed to extremely well done art.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's no better book to teach that material with. Mm. Than this book. There was a copy of Mouse in my fifth grade classroom. I remember that. Hyperprotectiveness is not what children want, and it doesn't serve them, and it doesn't serve the future. And so when I see people in my age demographic who are trying to shut down difficult art and trying to decide that this or that art doesn't deserve to exist, even if they're rooting it in the most problematic examples, then it's like, you don't get it. And you're going to grow up and you're going to get it and you're going to be mad that you fell into that trap. Because like, even when it's like absolutely not something you want to interact with, not something you want people to run into unprepared, you can't ever let any art not be out there, because what it does is it starts building a case. Like, there aren't a ton of examples where that kind of you push one domino and all of the other dominoes fall work, but free expression is one of those things where, unless it's like literally doing violence, you have to let it be out there. And I think it's important to have tagging systems. I think tagging systems are very valuable. I think having content warnings. Some people complain about content warnings as like spoilers. And I'm like, they're deciding to spoil it. Okay. Like, let your readers spoil themselves if they want to. Like, they aren't going to, like, if somebody like knows it's a book that has twists and they're willing to expose themselves to whatever in order to have a pure reading of the book, they'll just do that. It's like, sometimes people try to have so much control over what people read and how they read it, and it's just not realistic.
But, okay. What I think might be happening here, though, is that young aunties are being possibly manipulated, but still probably motivated by a desire to not be heard and not to hurt other people. That school board is using that as a beard for what is doing, which is to prevent little white Christian children from understanding how much bad has been done in their the name of their culture. And it's motivated to me by the same insanity that is making people rise up to keep what they think is critical race theory from being taught in schools, when what is really being taught is slavery was bad.
Yes.
Trying to, like, genocide happened and keeps happening and it shouldn't keep happening. And they don't like that because it makes people feel bad, right?
Yeah. And do you know what books are most commonly banned from school libraries? Queer books.
Yeah.
Right? And to little fanfare and little challenge. And there are absolutely kids in schools who need access to those books because they're not going to get any help at home. And they're not going to get any support at home. So it is very important to be vigilant about this and to shut down thinking that supports the removal of art from the hands of people who would not otherwise be able to get it, especially really important art like this.
Can I know that I'm like making our episode longer, but can I ask you about Harry Potter?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you and I agree that J.K. Rowling is a very problematic person with terrible opinions about trans people, right? Is there, has there ever been a feeling within yourself to say, nobody should read Harry Potter, or kids should not be exposed to Harry Potter because of that?
No, because I stand by my principles. The reason that so many people hold on to Harry Potter, despite the criticism it gets both from having its author but also from its content, is because it does connect with kids. It resonates with kids, and that has proved true through time. And I don't think it's fair to remove it from spaces. If somebody wanted me to buy a copy of a Harry Potter book for their kid, or take their kid to a Harry Potter event or whatever, then I would explain why I personally do not interact with the material that J.K. Rowling produces, and why I do not put money into that. And I would say, like, I can get you a gift card for a bookstore, or I can get you a used copy or whatever, but I will not directly support the book sales for this because I don't, it doesn't reflect my values personally, and I'm not going to give money to art I don't like, right? Like, it's not, you don't have to go around being like hyper egalitarian, like putting everything on the same level of personal funding or whatever. Right. It's just a matter of explain why you feel the way you feel, and then do what balances your relationships and your morals.
Yeah.
Imagine if people just did that for but I've thought a lot about that, and I've watched a lot of videos about J.K. Rowling from people who like those books and from people who don't like those books, and it did take processing to reach that conclusion where I'm like, okay, this is how I handle this, mm-hmm. right? But now I can carry that over into anything I feel that way about. And I think it is possible to entirely disavow an author and really enjoy aspects of their ideas. Like, I, like a lot of gay people, have read H.P. Lovecraft and have enjoyed H.P. Lovecraft. And right. I can also acknowledge he was not very technically talented and he was a horrible person.
Yes.
Right? But he had some home run ideas. So it feels kind of unfair to go, these ideas are tainted by being touched by the bigotry. So don't try to wash them off and make something good with them. Like, no, somebody would have invented a Cthulhu eventually. I'm sorry it was this guy, but I would like a Cthulhu, right? That's the power of adaptation, really. Yes. Like, I really respect Harry Potter fanfiction writers who try to fix what they have come to recognize as, not as good as the rest of it,
right?
So, yeah. We're going to do an ad, and then we're going to do some wrap-up.
Okay.
You kept asking me interesting questions that aren't in the script.
Sorry. Okay. This episode of That's a Thing is, as it turns out, brought to you by the Edmonton Public School Board. So here is a message about how you can take the guesswork out of going to school next year.
Get ready to take the guesswork out of choosing a school. Go to an Edmonton Public Schools virtual open house. Ask your questions to learn about their schools and programs, and find the one that feels right. All from the comfort of home. Find virtual event dates and learn how to make the most out of your online visit at openhouse.epsb.ca. Know before you go and feel confident and excited when you get there.
Again, that's openhouse.epsb.ca.
Really nailing it with the on-topic sponsors this time. So I think my era of internet was bad at teaching media analysis. There has since come about an era of internet that is good at it, which I'm
so
really happy
about.
The show notes are just going to be full of YouTube recommendations.
Yes.
for sure. But I was in a particularly bad time, and the way that English class is taught in Canada and in the United States, and I don't know where else it's taught differently in other places, I'm familiar with our systems, is not very good at this because it's focused on teaching the test.
Yeah.
And I think the worst example of this is how we assess English through multiple choice reading comprehension tests, which kind of everybody who has considered it agrees is bad. but we just keep them because how would we do it otherwise, right?
Yeah.
It would take so much energy. We'd probably have to hire more teachers and spend more time on it. We won't do that. So we're stuck with this system, right? And what it teaches you is binaristic thinking about art. Mm-hmm. You have A, B, C, D, right? What did the author intend? One of these four options, and one of them is correct.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't matter if you have a side take that's different or informed by your experience as well as the author's experiences or whatever, right? There's no room for that. It's just A, B, C, D. Mm-hmm. And it teaches kids to be very cynical about this and very dismissive about this and frustrated by it, especially when teachers are trying to teach a nuanced approach to interpretation and the test breaks it down to A, B, C, D later and you don't get to apply that. So the meme that encapsulates this is the why were the curtains blue meme. So this is like almost less of a meme and more of a text post.
Okay.
That circulated because it resonated with people and it's like the bane of my existence. But basically the teacher is standing in front of the class and the author has said the curtains were blue. This is the information we have from the author. The curtains were blue. And the teacher stands in front of the class and says, the author says that the curtains are blue to emphasize the sadness that is happening in this scene. It's an indication of the melancholia, da 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 da. Right? I'm making this meme much more intellectual than it actually is because I'm doing this from memory because it's living in my head rent-free. And then the student kind of quippily replies, the curtains were blue because the curtains were blue.
Mm.
Which is like, no. Nah. You have to evidence your point, Jason.
Yeah.
The teacher has implicitly evidenced their point because we know the color blue is associated with sadness. And so they extrapolated that. I need you to justify the author not paying particular attention to color descriptions in their text now, Jason. Argue your point. But they aren't taught to. They aren't taught to argue their point. They're taught to listen to their teacher and answer A, B, C, D, right? And it's just so bad for appreciating art. And so people who English class never hit with and who didn't have a natural interest in that, like I did, are just going about their life with that absolutely inadequate understanding of this stuff. And even people who are passionate about art and creation are under-equipped, and it leads to them getting sucked into these stupid binaristic fan wars. So on a personal level, I find that approaches to art as good or bad, either morally or in quality, have stagnated my creativity and made me intensely reluctant to share my art. I've had to carefully pluck the discourse around this from my Twitter feed, like mute by mute, no retweet by no retweet. No likes from you, thank you. I just had to peel it away because it was crippling my ability to write without fear of spurious judgment, disinterpretation, other things that are simply impossible to avoid, right? Because I was afraid of being labeled not a bad artist, but a bad person, right? Like, that's what I was worried about. And it's justified worry because it has happened to people. Right? And I've watched it happen to people for a long time. There are things, of course, that cannot be critiqued with kindness, which we only begrudgingly tolerate because we need to honor free expression. I stand by my principles. I think it should be allowed to exist. Dead dove, do not eat. Label it. And people can criticize whatever, right? Like, I support criticism, especially criticism without cruelty.
Yeah.
But we need room for enjoyment that doesn't privilege morality. And I've been reconnecting with camp lately and approaching art not as good or bad, but why does or doesn't this work for me, regardless of if it's good or bad? Sometimes something bad works for me, right? In her essay, Sontag says, camp is a solvent for morality. It neutralizes moral indignation. It neutralizes moral indignation, sponsors playfulness. Camp taste nourishes itself on the love that has gone into certain objects and personal styles. People who share this sensibility are not laughing at a thing they label as a camp. They're enjoying it. Camp is a tender feeling. The ultimate camp statement, it's good because it's awful. Of course, one can't always say that, only under certain conditions. But, you know, it's fun to say it's good because it's awful sometimes. It's good to me because it's bad. And just stand by that and stand by the contradiction and the irony and the nuance of it all, because God knows we need more of all of it. So there we go.
There we go. Well, thank you. You made me think about a lot of things. I have like a whole bunch of other things in my head, but I feel like maybe we should wrap up.
So. Part two, that's just not
making me think about stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is definitely one where you're going to want to read the show notes, and we will explain everything that we referenced here in case it whizzed by a little bit too fast, and I think we'll add some extra good art for people to look at.
Yeah,
and good analysis. So.
There's no good art, but you know, good art.
Yeah. Enjoyable art.
We like it.
Yes.
Works for us, art.
That's right. There's a show on the network called I Love This, You Should Too, and I think that's a good ethos.
Yeah.
But not you have to, and not you're a bad person if you don't love this too, right? All right. Well, you can follow our show on all the places where you can get podcasts. You can also find the show notes at thatsathing.transistor.fm. And of course, you can find us and all of the other outstanding members of the Alberta Podcast Network at albertapodcastnetwork.com. Many thanks to John for editing this episode. Also, I think we have warned you before. I'm warning you now. That's a Thing is coming to an end next month, which is February 2022. Elizabeth is about to be too old to tell you what the Youngs are up to, she claims.
I already find it grating. It's so fast. It's like how when you get older, you can't hear high-pitched sounds anymore. What was once fun is now cringe. I'm sorry. I can't pretend.
All right. So, if you have any final questions or farewell messages, you should send them our way before our grand finale at the end of February. You can do that on Twitter at That's a Thing Yeg, and you can always email us at That's a Thing Yeg at gmail.com. Is that everything?
That is all.
Thanks, sweetheart.
Bye.